This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 410 was produced on January 11th, 2024. I'm Eric Townsend. As promised at the end of last week's interview with Mark Nelson, we know you want us to focus not just on the future of nuclear energy, but also on how to invest in it right now. Uranium Insider newsletter publisher Justin Hune returns as this week's feature interview guest, and I promise he won't disappoint. Justin was on fire in this interview, so I let it run long. We'll refocus last week's broad-brush discussion of advanced nuclear technologies into the here and now, focusing on the immediate investment plays in the uranium mining sector, and how legislation now pending before the U.S. Congress only strengthens the bull case for uranium and uranium mining shares. I'd also like to announce that I've launched a new Substack blog to express my views and opinions that we don't have time to cover here on Macro Voices. Please subscribe at erictownsend.substack.com if you want to follow my work. The first post argues that nuclear fusion doesn't really offer much of value beyond what's already offered by thorium molten salt breeder reactors, a far more mature, developed, and proven technology. To my own astonishment, there's been no pushback whatsoever from the fusion community in the comments yet, but hopefully that will change soon.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, January 10th, 2024. The S&P 500 March futures were up 156 basis points to 48.20, currently approaching the December highs. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the postgame segment. The U.S. dollar index down 10 basis points to 102.35. The February WTI crude oil contract down 183 basis points to 71.37. We'll take a look at that chart in the postgame, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. The February RBOB gasoline futures down 417 basis points to 207. The February gold contract down 78 basis points to 2027. Stick around for the postgame after the interview where Eric and I will go in depth on the outlook on gold. Copper down 207 basis points to 378. Uranium up 185 basis points to 93.75, starting the year pressing new highs. The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 11 basis points, trading at 403. The key news to watch this week is Friday's producer price index. And next week, we have a kickoff to the earnings season, as well as in regards to economic news. We have the Empire State Manufacturing Index, retail sales, and the University of Michigan consumer sentiment numbers. This week's feature interview guest is Uranium Insider newsletter publisher Justin Hune. Eric, why did we invite Justin back as a guest this week?
My New Year's special episode with Mark Nelson got rave reviews, but we didn't cover any trading or investing themes directly, and we know that's what many of our listeners expect from us. Justin writes the only credible uranium investing letter that we're aware of, so it seemed like a perfect match to kick off the new year.
Well, Eric's interview with Justin Hune is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Uranium Insider founder and newsletter editor Justin Hune. Justin prepared a slide deck to accompany today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Click the red button above Justin's picture that says looking for the downloads. Justin, it's great to get you back on the show. Our listeners have enjoyed two full hours of Mark Nelson and I, or of me talking Mark Nelson's ear off about really high-level pie-in-the-sky stuff. I know our listeners want to dive into, okay, where's
the trading opportunity. How do we make money off of this sucker? So let's talk about this uranium bull market. Needless to say, it's undeniable that it's happening because a lot of the stocks that I have from your focus list in the newsletter, some of them are up 100% since they bottomed in March. So needless to say, the market is on. Let's talk about what's driving it, how long it can last, where it's headed, whether we're overdue for a correction and so forth. And I can't think of a better place to start than this beautiful chart you've got on page one of the deck.
Well, thanks for having me back, Eric. It's really good to discuss this uranium investing thesis again, because I think it's only improved since the couple of times we've spoken over the past 12 months. And it's looking very, very positive going forward, at least for the short and the midterm, and potentially for the long term as well, which is, I know that you personally have a focus on the long term for nuclear, which an unabashed nuclear proponent, regardless of the investment case. But the investment case is extremely strong here for uranium. And on that first slide, I'm showing just a really, really simple graph that shows current and projected supply and demand for nuclear. And this is basically just taking a structural snapshot showing the actual expected mined pounds out of the ground on an annual basis compared to the actual burn-up rate of the global nuclear reactor fleet. And you can see that we basically remain at a deficit even with expected peak production towards the end of the decade. Now, it's important to add some historical context here, Eric, which is the uranium sector has been short on the production side, let's say lower than annual demand every single year for probably about the past 30 years. There was a period of time where we had an absolute glut of production. And this was going back into the 80s when there was a full-on nuclear renaissance in the 70s and 80s where many countries are building dozens and dozens of reactors around the world. And we had an absolute explosion of mine supply. Now that was, of course, also to feed a few nations' nuclear warhead aspirations. And so, but we had a massive amount of production that far overshot annual reactor demand for close to a decade. And this is primarily in the 80s. And following that, since then, we've had a supply shortfall. The big difference between now and the previous markets, we had bull market back in the 80s and then again in the mid 2000s. The difference now is that there's very little secondary supply to balance that shortfall of production. So if we go back to the previous bull market, let's say 04 to 07, that was a very short, very violent bull market for the commodity. But even during that time, there was a supply deficit from primary production compared to primary demand. But you had an abundant amount of secondary supply coming from the megatons to megawatts program, which was a downblending of nuclear warheads to feed into civil nuclear programs. That was about 20 million pounds a year that went on for 20 years. And then towards the end of that bull market, you had secondary supply coming from enrichment underfeeding. And we can get into the weeds on that, but I'll skip it for now. Basically, to say there was 30 plus million pounds of secondary supply, even in the rip-roaring bull market of the mid-2000s. Bring us forward to today, megatons to megawatts ended in 2013, and that's over. There's very little government stockpiles being downloaded and sold into the market currently. And enrichment underfeeding has drastically dwindled over the past few years. So we now have maybe 15 million pounds of secondary supply, and that's in a good year currently right now. So it's a structurally short market, and regardless of where the price is at, which currently right now is sitting at $94 a pound uranium, we have a situation where pretty much any mine in the world can be making money here, yet we're going to remain at a supply shortfall for the foreseeable future. And there's many, many years to go before we have some big new mines come online. And that's kind of where we're at currently.
I have got several questions for you about this chart. You know, as much as this paints a beautifully, beautifully bullish picture, you know, listen, I've heard this story before. I was told at the end of the pandemic by a whole bunch of different experts, Justin, that it is physically impossible for the oil industry to ever get back to anything close to 13 million barrels a day. Well, here we are at 13.3 million barrels a day. And of course, what happened is the deficits that were being projected were very real. And so people responded by throwing capital at it, making investments, and building new production. So I really want to understand this chart, particularly with respect to whose projections are painting this picture that we're going to see this decline in production starting around 2028, 2029. And what amount of capital needs to come into this market in order to arrest that and say, you know, we just keep going up in production and we don't see this roll-off that's being predicted by this chart around 2030?
So this data from this chart is coming from UxC, and UxC is a nuclear fuel consultancy and analyst firm, and their primary clientele are nuclear utilities, and primarily in the United States, although they do have a global audience. So they really get into the weeds on every single tiny data point when it comes to production and demand, and they are the ones that are producing the data that created this graph. So looking at this, really what we're talking about in terms of what is needed to balance the market is just time, Eric, more than anything. The capital is there. The price of the commodity is technically there. But we've got a situation now where we have multiple entities that are going to be clamoring for a very, very small amount of supply. And that, in my estimation, is going to send the price much, much higher in the coming years. How high is anybody's guess? Incentive price, I would argue that we're within $10 to $20 of every single project in the world. Even the lowest grade mines in the United States and in Namibia, they can make money at $100, $105, $110 a pound. So it's just time. It doesn't matter how high that price goes. It just takes time to bring these projects online. For example, a couple of development projects that we can highlight just to give an example of how long this takes. NextGen's Arrow, which was discovered, I believe, close to 10 years ago. That is finally getting into kind of advanced stages of development. They haven't broken ground yet to actually build a mill and a mine. They're expecting to build the largest mill ever built for uranium and producing upwards of close to 30 million pounds a year, according to their feasibility study. That is still probably 4 to 5 years away until that is coming online. That's the biggest new mine coming online. And you have restarts in Namibia with Paladin's Langer Heinrich, a development project in Niger that is going to be probably another 2.5, 3 years away from production. Then you have a bunch of small stuff in the United States and Australia that just take a lot of time to come online. So we have this kind of this gap in time where there's just no levers to pull anymore. There's no secondary supply. Anybody who's holding inventory that could theoretically be selling into the market just isn't. And so while we've seen the price rise from the 30s to the 40s to the 50s to the 60s, now we're in the 90s. All along this bull market for the commodity, at every price level that I just mentioned, there's pontification that we're going to reach X price per pound, and all of a sudden you're going to see inventory flood into the market. And Eric, exactly the opposite has happened. We have to look at the evidence of what has happened, and those expectations from certain market participants in the past have absolutely not come to fruition. The largest holders of inventory by far are the Chinese, and they have been the most aggressive buyers over the last 18 months out of anyone in the world. So we have yet to see inventory be sold into the market. And generally speaking, when you look at nuclear, it is a very strategic, very important national security asset for any country that's operating a nuclear power plant. This isn't a commodity that is typically traded in large volumes just to, you know, pick up nickels in front of a steamroller. This is a strategic asset and fuel that can't be replaced. You absolutely have to have uranium for these nuclear power plants. And also, there's some element of price insensitivity for the nuclear utilities because uranium itself makes up only about 4% of the overall operating budget of a nuclear power plant. So you could actually see the price of conversion and enrichment of fuel fabrication stay relatively static and stable and flat, and the price of uranium go from $90 to $250 a pound, and it doesn't really move the needle that much for the bottom line of nuclear utilities. So there's plenty of upside ahead, and we don't really know what is going to be that lever that is going to be pulled eventually that brings some supply into the market other than new mined supply. And we can very easily predict on when that is going to come online. And it's not going to happen in sufficient volume for probably a 4 to 6 year period of time going forward.
Okay, I still feel like I'm missing something because in your prior interviews, you've explained what in-situ recovery is, ISR, where instead of having to go and, you know, drill up the countryside with a conventional mine that takes years and so forth to get online, ISR works by drilling what are essentially two water well type of wells down into an aquifer. They pump the water out and essentially filter the uranium out of it. It's both environmentally friendly, but as I understand it, it's also much faster to bring into production than a conventional mine. So with this big trend around ISR, it seems to me if there's plenty of capital available, Why, when we're looking at all the way out to 2030 before this cliff really starts to fall off here, why, if we had, starting in 2024, 2025, a wall of institutional capital available to these ISR companies that know how to do this and said, guys, look, wherever you can find a place that's opportune for ISR, do it. We'll give you the money. Couldn't they bring a whole bunch of production online pretty quickly?
That's something that I think is really important to address. And actually, Eric, if you look at slide number 4, we'll look at a prime example of the biggest ISR uranium producer in the world, which is Kazatomprom, that operates in Kazakhstan. Now, first of all, to answer your question very kind of high level, ISR only works in particular geology. So some geology, just no matter what, it is not amenable to ISR mining. This is why, for example, NextGen will be building an underground mine for Arrow. It's very, very deep. It's prohibitive for ISR. You have Global Atomic developing Dasa in Niger that's also not necessarily ISR amenable. They're building an underground mine. So the geology has to be right in the first place. There have been some breakthroughs in ISR technology, for example, with Denison Mines and their Phoenix deposit in Saskatchewan. And we haven't seen ISR done in the Athabasca Basin yet, and they are developing an ISR project there, and it looks like it's going to work. So that's fantastic. Still, NextGen's Phoenix, even though they've proven out the ISR amenability of this deposit over the last 18 months, we're still 4 to 5 years away from first uranium out of the ground there, even though it's ISR. But back to Kazakhstan and Kazatomprom. If you look at the graphic in the lower left-hand side of that slide, the wellfield block production profile. So you typically have a lag time of about 18 months from first wells drilled to peak production in any given wellfield. And this is in geology and the grades that are absolutely ideal for ISR. Kazakhstan has been able to ramp production in an unbelievable fashion from the early 2000s till now. Their peak production was 2016, which happened to coincide with the absolute bottom price for the commodity at $16 a pound or $18 a pound. But still, you have this situation now where the price is pushing $100 a pound. There's plenty of capital available in Kazakhstan for Kazatomprom and their joint venture partners to expand these deposits. And they have even guided to the market that they plan to expand their development in production numbers this year, 2024, and in 2025. So for the past 3 years, they've been operating at what they call 20% below their subsoil use agreement. So technically, they have these subsoil use agreement, basically licenses for production, and they're allowed to go within 20% up or down of those levels. They've been operating supposedly voluntarily below these levels for the past few years. Just about 6 months ago, they projected for 2024, they would move their production up to 10% below that subsoil use level, which is about 25,500 tons, or about 65, 66 million pounds of uranium on a 100% basis. And for 2025 to go to subsoil use levels, to 100% of their subsoil use level agreements, which would be 30,500 tons, or about 80 million pounds of uranium. Now, it's important to understand that if the money is there, the capital is there, that the geology is there, the technical skill sets are there for their their employees, that why aren't they ramping production yet? Now, that's a really important question to ask, because all of that is there. Why can't they just turn on the taps that everybody has feared over the past 5 years? And there's been, I know people that have stayed entirely out of this investment because they have basically theorized that Kazatomprom can just quote unquote turn on the taps. So what can we expect for 2024 and potentially 2025 from Kazakhstan and Kazatomprom specifically? You would need to see, based on this lag time for production out of the ISR wells, you would have to see the CapEx jump up. You have to see them increase their wellfield CapEx in order to expect increased production about 12 months following that CapEx increase. What did we see? They've revised down in their Q3 reporting, they revised down their overall CapEx, their expected CapEx expenditure for wellfield development for 2023. They revised it down, not up. We expect in the next 2 to 3 weeks, they're going to come to the market, they're going to report on 2023, they're going to update their guidance for 2024, and we expect that they're going to say to the market they're not going to hit their targets. We are very skeptical that they're even going to come remotely close to their targets for 2025. And with all of that said, the bulk of their production increases are coming from a single deposit, the Budenovskoye 6 and 7 deposit that is a joint venture with Russia. And all of that uranium that will come out of that mine for the first 5 years is going to Russia. Not only Russia's share, but Kazatomprom's share is already committed to be sold to Russia. So This is not a relief for the market, even if we do see them increase production. So far, we have not seen their CapEx increase.
Justin, I'm so glad that you mentioned Kazakhstan. It sets me up perfectly to go back to slide one now, because I really want to understand this projection. I want to understand what it's based on and how it could change, because it seems to me that there is a huge amount of uncertainty right now about which way the geopolitical winds are going to blow. You know, the conflict with Ukraine seems to be winding down. You could take one scenario which says, okay, so that means that the U.S. and Russia are going to kiss and make up and renormalize foreign relations, and we're going to lift sanctions and everything's going to get better and we'll go back to open trade with that part of the world. The other scenario at the opposite extreme would be that China and Russia form an ever-strengthening alliance and we see a new Cold War that builds up to more and more tension that further bifurcates the world so that there's basically no trade in things like uranium between Russia and the United States. And I know you've got a slide coming up to talk about some new legislation that the U.S. has been introducing on that front. So as I look at this graph on slide number one, is that based on an assumption that this is global production and that there's free market trade that's unrestricted by sanctions? Or is it based on something else? And what if we did get to a very bifurcated market? What would that do in terms of Western access to supply to this bottom part of the chart here?
That's a really, really good question. So this chart is actually quite simplistic. This is looking at overall global total demand from expected reactor operation going out into the future. This, of course, has to make a lot of assumptions about reactor shutdowns, life extensions, new construction, timing of grid connections, et cetera, on the demand side. The production side is a little bit easier because there's not a whole lot of potential as far as we can see currently, or UxC themselves can see currently, of some surprises to the upside on the production side of things. The surprises would probably generally be to the downside and usually are, especially in terms of the timelines for development taking far longer and costing more, which is how it works in mining, period, not just for uranium. So this is a very simple chart. It's how much is the world going to produce of uranium? And this is specifically U308. This is yellow cake. This is the uranium mined out of the ground. And how does that compare to the expected demand of the world's reactors? It doesn't have any sort of geopolitical takes whatsoever. With all of that said, if we were to go to, let's say, world peace in the next 6 months, and all of a sudden we have a completely open global market again, and even if we go back 2 years, that wasn't really the case because we've had something called the Russian Suspension Agreement in the United States for a number of years that actually limits the amount of uranium that U.S. utilities can buy from Russia to about 25% per year. But even going back to that, really what we are talking about here is Russia has a major stake. They're the largest producer of enrichment in the world by far. So they're, you know, 40-something percent of enrichment on a global basis and 30-something percent of conversion. I don't have the numbers right off the top of my head, but they're the biggest player in both of those markets. So Russia, if Russian enrichment all of a sudden was open to the global marketplace again, and technically it still is, what we've seen is just Western utilities have been sort of hedging this geopolitical situation by voluntarily avoiding new business with Russia. But if we did see the market open back up on a global basis to Russian enrichment, we could see enrichment prices drop. We could see underfeeding coming from Russia come back into the global marketplace. And that would help a little bit. That possibly could, you know, slow down the price rise here, but you can't replace uranium. When you have an incredible excess of enrichment capacity and not a lot of demand, you can sort of buy enrichment for uranium. But once you have limited enrichment and you don't have the uranium to fulfill into those enrichment conversion and enrichment contracts, you have to buy the uranium. And that's sort of the situation we're in right now. So even if we sort of reverted back to how things were, let's say 20, 24, 30 months ago, we're still going to be remaining in a uranium bull market, and the Russians are short uranium. I'll repeat, the Russians are short uranium. They have a lot of conversion. They have a lot of enrichment. They don't have a lot of uranium. They've been buyers of uranium. In fact, over the last 5 years, historically speaking, they've been marginal sellers of uranium in the spot market. Uranium One has been. They are buyers this year. They've been buying enrichment. They've been buying U308. And they obviously took this massive joint venture, Rosatom, with Budenovskoye 6 and 7 with Kazatomprom. And this is by far the biggest development project besides NextGen's Arrow in the world. So they're short uranium. They've got 18 reactors. They're currently under construction worldwide right now with their exports. We're talking about Rosatom's exports globally. They need yellow cake. And so even if their enrichment and conversion business was open again globally, they're still short uranium. So it's not really a fix.
Is it possible to make a chart like this one that shows what the Western world would look like if we just looked at Western demand, not global demand for reactor supply, and then looked at production that will be available to the West no matter what? You know, all the production that's coming out of places like Nevada and Canada and Australia, which is not going to, we're not going to lose access to that. If we only had access to that supply and no other supply, would this get better or worse? And how much worse?
I would say it would arguably get worse. However, the bulk of the growth of nuclear is happening in China. So if you were to bifurcate, let's say OECD versus, you know, the BRICS countries, for example, you would see a more stable and slower growth rate on the demand side. But you'd also see, if you're talking about Kazakhstani pounds not coming to the West, then yeah, there's an absolutely dire production situation for the West if they don't have access to Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan pounds. There's plenty of in-situ resources. Australia has more uranium in the ground than any other continent by far. So there's plenty of uranium in the US and Canada and Australia and their other allied nations that if they just got their stuff together, they could actually produce far more than they would need. It just takes time. It takes capital. It takes time.
Justin, forgive me for jumping all around the slide deck, but let's take a look at page 6. First, tell us what's going on here with respect to this U.S. legislation that's pending.
So last month in December of 2023, the House passed U.S. 1042. This is a bill to ban Russian uranium imports into the United States. This passed with flying colors. They attempted to fast track that through the Senate. It was blocked by Senator Cruz in Texas, apparently for reasons that had nothing to do with the bill. He probably just wanted to add some pork into that bill for his constituency, most likely. But now it is going to a Senate vote probably within the next few weeks. It is highly likely to pass. It has bipartisan support. It has support of major nuclear advocacy organizations in the United States, which means that most utilities in the United States are actually in support of this bill passing. Now, some interesting elements to this bill are that there are going to be waivers that can be offered by the Department of Energy or by the Secretary of Energy going out through December of 2027. And these waivers would allow a U.S. utility to continue to receive deliveries of Russian enriched uranium if they can prove that they can't source the material elsewhere in the time frame that they need. With all of that said, there is a non-zero chance that Russia could retaliate to this bill passing and actually cut off exporting the material to the United States. This is something that has been highlighted by the previously mentioned UXC in their communications with the utilities, that there's a serious risk of this happening. And this is, you know, the money that is made from Russians selling enrichment to the United States is a rounding error compared to the income that Russia has from, let's say, oil and gas, for example. So this could be very much a wartime, quote unquote, wartime move. It's certainly shaken up the market. It's not something that we're betting on passing. We're not betting around this. We don't really think this is much of a catalyst necessarily because of these waivers. But if this bill passes, we are probably going to see a market reaction because there's going to be some expectation that Russia could retaliate and actually cut off those deliveries.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask you about, is the retaliation scenario, because I've been hearing that narrative, and it seems to me, exactly as you said, this is a form of weaponization of energy prices that Putin can afford. A lot of people have been concerned about Putin weaponizing oil prices, but the thing is, if you take that Russian oil production offline, it's hard to put it back online. Once you shut in those wells, they can't necessarily be restarted without a huge amount of investment, and you may lose some production capacity permanently along the way. Whereas with cutting off access to uranium or uranium enrichment, and I want to focus particularly on the conversion and enrichment capabilities, from what I understand, most of the capacity for conversion and enrichment is over there. So imagine that this happens, that you start with this House bill that gets passed by the Senate, and the strategy of U.S. lawmakers is, okay, this is an opportunity for us to, you know, kind of show the American people that we're getting tough with Russia, but in reality, we've got all of these exemptions built into the bill so that we don't really have to enforce it. Then Putin comes back and says, no, you passed it. We're gonna stick with it. We're going to just cut off all commerce around uranium and uranium enrichment and uranium conversion services. It's no longer available. I don't understand how much of those conversion and enrichment services are in Russia versus in other countries like Kazakhstan that are kind of in that sphere of influence, but not directly under Putin's control. To what extent are we at risk of a conversion and enrichment crisis? And if we are at risk of that, how long would it take to build that capacity in the United States?
I think there's a decent risk there. The actual Russian entities that are providing these services don't want to cut off deliveries for obvious reasons. So we've actually seen statements come out of 10X, which is the Russian Enrichment Corporation, state-owned corporation that provides enrichment and enriched uranium to their global customers. They don't want to renege on a contract. They don't want to be seen in the global marketplace as not being reliable. And, you know, my understanding is in the history of Russian nuclear services, they have not missed a single delivery ever. So this would literally have to come on from Putin's administration in order for them to actually cut off these deliveries. So I don't think there's a strong chance of this happening, but there is a chance that it happens. The U.S. is doing a decent job of trying to ramp up their, in particular, enrichment, because we already have conversion here. We have conversion that can be expanded. That's at Comerdine's Metropolis plant in Illinois. They're currently producing, I think it's 7,000 tons of conversion per year. They can ramp up to 12 or 13,000 tons relatively easily. They just want higher prices. My understanding is it was extremely painful for them to shut down operations like they did in 2018 for five years. But that does have the capacity expansion possibility. Enrichment's another story. The primary enrichment in the United States is actually owned by the UK at Urenco, New Mexico. But just today, Eric, there was the announcement that the Department of Energy is issuing a $500 million RFP, a request for proposal for low-enriched uranium and high-assay low-enriched uranium HALEU for advanced reactors that they're going to be awarding to multiple entities to try to get that capacity ramped up and funded. They want to get off of Russian uranium. They want to have HALEU for these demonstration projects. There's two demonstration projects right now in the United States. It's TerraPower's Natrium Reactor, Wyoming, X Energy's XE100 in Washington. Both of these projects operate on HALEU. Guess what? The only HALEU in production currently is basically coming from Russia. Centrus is just starting to produce the very first amount of HALEU here in the U.S., and going forward, we're going to want to be expanding that HALEU so we can actually fuel, at the very least, these demonstration projects and hopefully the future of advanced nuclear in the United States and beyond. So they're doing their best to do it. Urenco has announced that they are expanding enrichment. So not necessarily U.S., but we're talking about a U.S. ally is expanding enrichment. Orano is expanding enrichment. And I think Orano might have mentioned they are looking into expanding conversion as well. Port Hope in Canada is just about at full capacity. They might be able to expand a little bit, but it'll take some time, Eric. Even with the funding and the incentive there, we're still looking probably at another 3 years before we see Urenco's expansion up and running. And it could take about the same amount of time to see ConverDyn expand conversion. We also have the Springfields plant in the UK, which has been shuttered for a very long time, but we have Westinghouse that operates Springfields or owns Springfields, did get a grant from the UK to look into the restarting of that conversion facility. So it's the West is taking action. Will it be fast enough in enough capacity? That'll be hard to say. But if Russia does actually voluntarily say and retaliate and cut off both conversion and enrichment for existing contracts with Western customers, that is going to shake up the market pretty significantly, at least for the short term.
Justin, as you were speaking, I realized that we probably have a lot of new listeners who are not familiar with the nuclear fuel cycle, and we may be confusing them. So I just want to point out that Justin's prior interviews on Macro Voices, which you can find just by typing Justin's name, just Justin is all you need to put into the search box at macrovoices.com. We go through in detail what the nuclear fuel cycle looks like. Very briefly, you start by mining uranium. That either happens out of a conventional mine or in situ recovery. That uranium has to be converted into a gas. That's called conversion. Once it's into a gas form, it has to be enriched to a usable concentration of the fissile material in uranium, which is called U-235. That occurs either in a centrifuge or there's a new way of doing it using lasers. So that's all explained in prior interviews. I want to come back to laser enrichment now because I know you've been looking at that recently, Justin. Is laser enrichment ready to make a meaningful difference? Let's say we did have a further bifurcation. We don't have access to the conversion and enrichment facilities that are in the Eastern countries that might be under the influence of Putin, and we need to get our own separate enrichment capacity built up in the West, particularly in the United States. Can laser enrichment come riding in as the white horse that comes to the rescue, or is it the technology not there yet?
It looks really promising, Eric. I don't know that it's going to be a panacea, but it looks very promising. So Global Laser Enrichment, which is owned by Silex and Cameco, they are building out their demonstration plant in the United States that should be operational this year. Then they're looking at commercial production from basically re-enriching depleted tails at a former enrichment facility in the United States in Paducah, Kentucky. Commercial production from that facility in 2027 or 2028, if I recall. I think that at that time, that'll only be about 5 million pounds per year of U3O8 equivalent in the form of UF6. But it looks really positive. We already have some letters of intent coming from the largest U.S. utilities with Global Laser Enrichment. So I think that the industry has their fingers crossed and has high hopes for this. But even at 5 million pounds of U3O8 equivalent capacity 5 years from now or 4 years from now, it's not going to fill that gap that's needed both for conversion, because they can spin depleted tails into UF6 and sort of take the place of conversion as well. So it's not just to low-enriched uranium at 4.5%, 5%. We're talking about just getting back up from depleted tails to 0.7%, which is what natural uranium or UF6 is. But it looks positive, Eric. I think there's a lot of hope in the industry for the future for laser enrichment, for sure.
Justin, my apologies for jumping all around the deck, but let's go back to page one here on the deck, because I do want, before we move on to the rest of the sequence that you had planned, just to come back to this question of whether or not we can do anything to prevent this decay that starts at 2030 or so. If we had plenty of institutional capital, we're ready to drill more ISR wells and you know, make more mines and so forth, and we throw a bunch of capital at it, seems to me like, you know, we got 6 years before 2030 when this chart really starts to take a nosedive. Isn't that enough time to bring a whole bunch of new supply online in order to solve this problem?
Theoretically, it is. And, you know, I don't think that uranium is different than other commodities in the sense that eventually high prices will be the cure for high prices and we'll have supply respond to that price environment. I think that that will be the case. This graph, however, is basically looking at, and we're going back to slide one still with the supply and demand graph. It's essentially looking at known development projects that can get into production with the incentive price in place. But the reason that it drops off so steeply, Eric, is because those known deposits that could be developed into production over the next, let's say, 6-7 years is also coming up against big decline rates in the currently producing mines. So we're talking about Cigar Lake starting to decline. I think it's actually going to start to decline sooner than Cameco is flagging. Cameco and Orano have a joint venture with Cigar Lake in Saskatchewan. But still, phase one of Cigar Lake is expected to basically be coming offline in 2027, 2028. Will they go into phase two? They say that they will. The market understands that phase two is lower grades, more difficult, more expensive to mine. But you also have big decline rates of the known deposits in Kazakhstan. I think they could do a lot of exploration, drilling, and discover a lot more deposits in that country. So I tend to fade that a bit. But still, known existing producers are running into decline rates already. And those big mines that are producing now will start to see decline rates towards the end of the decade and into the 2030s. So we're going to need even more production from new discoveries and from some of these massive historic resources that are known in Canada, in Australia, et cetera. And we're going to need a pricing environment to support the development of those projects and a capital environment. Eventually, the nuclear advocate in me likes to think that we will see high enough prices for uranium that we can see some new technologies develop in the 2030s and beyond, because I want to see, you know, the COP28 goals of tripling nuclear by 2050, like I mentioned in slide, let's see, that's slide five. I want to see those goals be met, I think, for the benefit of humanity and for clean energy globally. In order for that to happen, it's hard to believe that the mined supply in the ways that we're doing it now is going to meet that demand on an annual basis if we actually achieve those goals. So I'm hoping for a future of uranium coming from phosphate tails, uranium coming from seawater. It's going to take some technological innovations. It's going to take very high prices that are sustained. But I think we'll get there eventually. But of course, those, Eric, are many, many, many years away, probably far beyond the scope of this investment.
Justin, that's, I promise, will be my last question on slide number one before we move on to the rest of the slide deck. It seems to me that as much as this is an incredibly bullish story after 2030, hey, wait a minute. If we look at the immediate term, there is actually still a narrowing of this supply-demand gap for the next couple of years. And this market has run, 100% up since March or so. Are we maybe looking at a significant correction before this really big bull market starts? And should we be concerned about that, especially as more people are getting concerned about broad market weakness?
That's always the million-dollar question, Eric, is what are the equities going to do? Because the commodity itself, to say that we're looking for a correction in the commodity, absolutely not. I don't think that this commodity trades on technicals whatsoever. It's a needed fuel for important assets globally. And the nuclear fuel buyers that operate, the utilities that operate the nuclear power plants, they buy uranium when they have to buy uranium. And like I mentioned, it's a small percentage of their overall operating budget. So regardless of where the price is at, if they need it, they buy it. Period, the end. That does make it very unique in that sense. The equities, however, uranium stocks are still stocks. And regardless of how good the fundamentals are, sometimes the stocks will not move with the commodity. They'll move against the movement of the commodity. There's plenty of historical precedent for that. I've highlighted to our membership multiple times of a great example of this in the previous bull market, where we had Q305 to Q306. We had the spot price go up about 50%. We had the S&P up almost 10%. And we had the uranium stocks down about 30 to 40% over that same period of time. Of course, what happened after that was the last couple of legs of the market, where most of the stocks in the space doubled, tripled, quadrupled over the course of about 6 or 7 months. It was an absolute crazy blow off top. So the equities are going to do what the equities are going to do. Generally, on balance, they were going to follow the trajectory of the commodity, as most mining stocks tend to do. But on slide two, you can see I dug up a little bit of historical data to show us where we're at in terms of relative valuation. So I picked three companies that are trading now that were trading in the previous market: Denison Mines, Cameco, and Paladin. And we're looking at the enterprise value of the company, which is basically the market cap minus cash plus debt. Most of these companies don't have a lot of debt on the balance sheet anyway, so that's pretty close to their market caps. But I had the historical data for EV versus their in-situ resources, so that's what I went with. So we're looking at their total pounds in the ground in-situ resource, comparing that to the enterprise value of the company, and what that valuation kicks out currently. So right now, Denison Mines, for example, with an in-situ resource of just over 200 million pounds and an enterprise value of 1.4 billion, they've got an enterprise value versus their pounds at $6.77. Well, in 2006, at $50 uranium, which inflation adjusted is about $76 a pound right now, they were trading at almost $24 EV to pounds in the ground. And I know this is not a perfect analogy or a perfect comparison to make, but it's about as good as you can get for a company that is not necessarily cash flowing yet and wasn't either back then. It's just looking at relative valuations compared to the previous bull market and what these equities can do when sentiment really gets heated up and when you actually see a lot of money come into the sector. It's such a small sector. It was back then. It still is now. And these things have a long ways to run, in my opinion, in terms of relative valuation compared to the previous market. Looking at Cameco, enterprise value of 17.5 billion, a billion pounds in the ground, 16.95 EV to pounds, compared to 06 at $50 a pound, 24.57. And Cameco is about half the price in terms of their valuation versus their in-situ resources compared to 06. So we're nowhere near an overheated market in terms of valuations for the equities. And the chart right below that spreadsheet screenshot that I have there, Eric, is showing URA compared to the spot price of uranium. We are literally at the same levels that we saw in the COVID crash for the valuation, the share price of URA compared to the spot price of uranium. Of course, there's more outstanding shares right now, so the valuation on balance of that ETF is higher than it was during the COVID crash, clearly. But it is a good visual comparison to see where we're at in terms of the equities versus the metal. In my opinion, we're going to have substantial leverage with the equities going forward when the market really heats up, and we're certainly not there yet.
It seems to me that what this chart is telling us is that people are speculating that, okay, it must be that uranium is just at an artificially high price and it's not going to last. In other words, the people that are trading the equities are not really putting faith in the high price of uranium being an indication that that trend is going to continue. They think it's about to blow off or something. I don't see any reason to think that. Am I missing something here?
No, you're not missing something. I think, you know, if you look at a chart for example, like the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, it's gone up like a hockey stick, and it's psychologically sometimes difficult to buy that. I mean, it is difficult for me to buy that, right? Even with what I know in the market, I look at a chart like that, I have a very, very hard time buying something that looks relatively overbought and has just gone up almost vertically about over the past 6 months. But when you take a step back and think about, okay, we're at $94 a pound, inflation adjusted, what is that, about $70 a pound in 05, 04, 05. The price went from 70 to 134 in 07. So that's about $200 a pound inflation adjusted. This could seriously double and only meet the levels that we saw in the previous market. And remember, the previous market did not even really have a structural supply deficit because of that secondary supply. We have a massive and sustaining supply deficit in this situation. We have utilities that are decently uncovered in terms of their uranium buying needs going out into the future. And that could actually bring us to slide three, Eric, which is looking at the long-term contracting cycle. I know I mentioned in one of our previous interviews that the primary way that utilities procure uranium to operate their facilities is through long-term contracts. It's not necessarily by buying in the spot market. So this graph on slide number three is looking at the annual volume signed in term contracts. And you can see 05, 06, 07, huge amounts of term volume, 250 million pounds in 2005. And you have to remember, in 2005, the annual demand for uranium was probably about 165 million pounds. So this was far, far greater than that replacement rate level for contracting. Then we get into the oversupplied 2010s following the Fukushima Daiichi accident, the shutting down of all of Japan's reactors, the shutting down of some of Germany's reactors, the supply glut in the market, Kazakhstan ramping production during that period of time as well. And what happened? You had an oversupplied market that utilities could buy abundantly in the spot market. They could buy abundantly from carry trades rather than engaging in these long-term contracts with producers. And you had multiple years of less than replacement rate contracting. So term contracting volumes far less than the annual burn rate of the reactors. So they were drawing down inventories. They were buying cheap in the spot market. They were buying via carry trades. Finally, bring us to 2022. We see a little bit of a jump in the term contracting market. The invasion of Ukraine certainly kicked that into gear a bit. Then last year, 160 million pounds were signed in the term contracting market. This, of course, the term contracting reporting from UxC grabs about 85% of the market. So basically, we're pretty much at replacement rate. About 180 million pounds a year is the annual burnup rate for 2023. So we believe that 2023 was year one of what is going to be a multi-year period for replacement rate contracting, or as you might call it, a contracting cycle. And this is what has happened historically in this market. You've got a 5-6 year period of at least replacement rate levels being contracted in the TERP market. Last year was year one. We have a lot of uncovered demand coming in the number of years ahead in a market that is very undersupplied. It could get pretty crazy on the price side, Eric. It really could. We just don't have sufficient supply to meet the demand that's coming. I actually sincerely have some concerns that we're going to see bidding wars between utilities and potentially even with financial players at the same time for a minimal amount of pounds. It's possible that we're going to see RFPs not filled. It could get pretty wild here. We've got a dire supply situation at the very beginning of a contracting cycle.
Justin, you mentioned seawater recovery a moment ago. I want to come back to that, but in the context of a broader discussion of the long-term big picture for where this market can go, because as you've shown on page 5, we just had 25 countries at the COP28 conference in Dubai, which is the climate conference. So this to me is incredibly significant because what we see is the environmentalist community, the climate community that used to oppose nuclear is now getting behind nuclear and getting behind nuclear in a huge way. They're talking about tripling the amount of nuclear energy that exists in the world. And remember that slide that you had on page 1, that was just showing existing reactor demand. It doesn't consider what would happen in the future if we triple the amount of nuclear energy that exists in the world. That's going to create even more demand. Now, as I understand it, there's just an almost unlimited amount of uranium in seawater, but the recovery of that uranium from seawater doesn't get economic until about $200 to $250 uranium price. So in my mind, it seems like the setup here is for a bull market in uranium over at least the next decade that overshoots that price, let's say maybe by 100%, all the way to $500 uranium. But then I think it has to come back down, because if you get to those kind of prices, that's going to incentivize a huge investment in seawater recovery, something that doesn't even exist today, but is theoretically possible. And I think that probably brings a cap into the market at some point around $300 a pound in today's dollars, once you get to seawater recovery, which basically is unlimited in terms of capacity, as I understand it. Does that make sense, or am I thinking about this the right way?
Yeah, I think that that's entirely possible. It's hard to really say what technologies will come forward with. We have sustained prices in that realm that you just discussed. Seawater technology is being developed currently. The Chinese are working on it. They don't have a lot of in situ resources for uranium in China, so they've had to contract a lot, building up very large contracts with Kazatomprom, expanding their development in Kazakhstan, kicking tires in Africa. Currently, we're probably going to see some more projects being taken over by Chinese entities. But they're also looking at, especially considering their build-out program, I think they have 20-something reactors under construction right now, 24, 25 under construction as we speak. They're going to need to shore up their uranium production or uranium sourcing as we go out into the 2030s and 2040s and beyond. These are very long-lived assets. The reactors being built right now are going to be operating into the 2060s, 2080s, and potentially beyond. So they're going to have to shore that up. Even at, let's just say, theoretically, the existing technologies for extracting seawater for uranium are viable at $200 to $250 a pound uranium. The thing that's important to remember, just like with mining, is when we hit $200 to $250 of uranium, $250 per pound of uranium, that doesn't necessarily mean that all of a sudden we have incredible production coming from the ocean. It's going to take some time to build these assets and to nail that technology down, that first-of-a-kind technology down, to get that production going. But I tend to think, generally speaking, Eric, I think you're onto something here. I think we're going to see the price vastly overshoot where it technically needs to be and then settle back down to a price that sustains the industry. And I think that could even happen multiple times over an overall bullish next decade plus. We could see it on the mining side. We could maybe see the price run up above $200 a pound and drop back down once we have DASA producing and Paladin back online at 100% and the Kazakh expansion and Arrow and Phoenix producing. Like, all of those things happen by 2028. That might be a time where the price will settle back down to where it sustains the industry. But following that, just like the graph on slide 1 shows, we've got decline rates for the existing producers matching off essentially kind of the new production coming online. So we're going to probably see a very, very long-term bull market for uranium. I think that you're absolutely right with that. I also, Eric, you know, we communicated prior to this recording about the what this COP28 pledge really means, because it's hard to say what all of these countries that have pledged to triple nuclear energy by 2050 are going to individually do to help meet that goal. But what it does do, to your point, is it does sort of give permission for the environmental left to embrace nuclear. This is a very, very big coming out party, to call it, for lack of a better word, for nuclear in the environmental movement. I really think this is a huge watershed moment for nuclear. And a couple of examples of countries actually moving in the right direction following this, of course, the U.S. With their RFP for enrichment that just came out today. We saw that the U.K. is investing, gosh, I think it was also $500 million towards enrichment, if I recall correctly, and expanding new nuclear. And the French announced just last weekend that they plan to build a total of 14 new EPR2 reactors. These are huge 1,650-watt reactors. They already had plans to build 6 new reactors. Now they're upping with an additional 8 to a total of 14. I believe that time frame for the total of 14 is to be operational between 2035 and 2040. Either way, there looks like they're stepping up to help meet that goal. So, the graph on chart one shows the demand expected from existing reactors that are under construction currently. It doesn't take into account these goals possibly even coming close to being met and what that could look like on the demand side.
I'm glad you brought that up, Justin, because this is something I've been thinking a lot about. I'm surprised that it hasn't really had an effect in the market yet, but it seems to me if you're an ESG fund manager and you've been losing money hand over fist for the last several years and are trying to figure out how to save your existence, if all of the sudden it becomes politically acceptable for ESG funds to invest in nuclear energy, it seems to me like, and you know, it's, if I was the ESG manager, I would be saying, let's only invest in ISR. Let's just sort of, you know, make that what we're going to hang our hat on. The way we're being environmentally responsible is we believe in nuclear energy, but we don't believe in old-fashioned mining. So we're only going to invest in ISR stocks that are doing the more ecologically and environmentally friendly approach to producing uranium. And that's the way we're going to invest. It seems to me that a lot of those stocks that are ISR-centric uranium-producing companies could potentially see just incredible capital inflows if that ESG, you know, there's so much institutional money in ESG that unfortunately has not made very much money in recent years. Seems to me like this could be their salvation. I'm surprised that it hasn't happened yet. What do you make of this? Am I too optimistic about a change in the attitude of ESG managers?
Possibly. And I'm not sure that ESG is going to necessarily focus on ISR. I agree with you that generally speaking, it is a more environmentally friendly means of production. Usually, that's not necessarily always the case. I was speaking specifically about historical means of ridding themselves of spent sulfuric acid in Kazakhstan, for example, has not necessarily been the most environmentally friendly process. But there is some ISR producers in the United States that are essentially using oxygenated water as the lixiviant to pull uranium out of the ground. You could drink the fluid that they're using to actually mine the uranium. It's that clean. So in some cases, that's the case. But I think a broader picture really is just lumping nuclear energy together in with other ESG accepted investments. And if you want to invest in nuclear, or I guess in uranium stocks, because there's not a lot of options to invest in nuclear itself in publicly traded markets, there's only a handful of options that are liquid enough to offer position sizes that are meaningful to large money managers. And those primarily are the ETFs, and then, of course, Cameco, and to some extent, NextGen, UEC, Paladin, et cetera. But mostly it's the ETFs and the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. And what we've seen over the past couple of years, and especially over the past 6 to 12 months, is a substantial increase in positioning into URA by institutions. So the percentage of overall outstanding shares that are owned by institutions continues to climb higher and higher for URA, and the ETFs, historically speaking, are majority held by retail. So that's a good sign that it is happening. And I do think that this COP28 event was a big, big plus for the industry in terms of ESG acceptance of nuclear.
Justin, we already covered slide 6. Let's move on to page 7, which is your final slide. Let's talk about what's going on in the mining industry with respect to labor.
This is something I think that is not discussed often enough. And if you go to slide number 7, Eric, this is something that existing producers right now of uranium are running into supply problems, both supply chains that have improved somewhat from COVID, but are still very inhibited compared to how they have been historically. So, for example, even over the last few years, a contact of mine at one of the major mines. I'm going to keep it anonymous for the sake of this conversation, but where before you would be able to have some necessary part for ongoing operations within a few days, you might be waiting a few weeks to a few months now, and you're going to be paying twice as much for it. That's just the supply chains. The skilled labor is in extreme shortage. So there's a bullet point on slide number 7. More than half of the U.S. mining workforce, about 221,000 people, is expected to retire by 2029. And I'm telling you, the youth are not interested in going into this, into these industries, going into the skilled trades. This is going to be an incredible problem that the industry is going to have going forward. And not just this industry, it's pretty much all skilled trades, but uranium is no exception to that. So it just going back to the expected production from these development projects, they always take longer and they always cost more. And these are two major reasons for that. So the supply projections, typically when you do like a supply demand modeling, you'll do it conservatively and you'll basically expect that the production will happen when the company tells you that it will. But when these things actually pan out, it never works out like that. And just talking with multiple development and producing companies and my contacts at these companies, I can tell you that they're struggling right now. And these are existing large companies, plenty of capital, plenty of history, great packages to attract these skilled laborers, and they're struggling in a major way to actually do so. So I don't know what that means for the projects that are not yet producing and are going to have to do something to attract these skilled people from a global marketplace of skilled labor. It's going to be a challenge, and it's going to inhibit the timeline for production coming online.
It's definitely something I've heard from people in the oil patches. You know, right now in the Bakken, there are jobs for unskilled workers. All you need is, you know, you don't even need a high school diploma. You just need to be an able-bodied soul that's willing to move to North Dakota. And you can make upwards of $100,000 a year in entry-level jobs. And the response of the youth in inner cities, Los Angeles, whatever, is move to Dakota? No, thanks. Just for $100,000? Nah. Don't want to do that. I want to ask you one final question about the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, Justin, which is an investment vehicle that's become extremely popular. You recommend it to your subscribers, and I certainly have a position in it. But as I understand its strategy, it intentionally takes physical supply off the market. In other words, they're not just trying to use the futures market to invest in the price of uranium. They're buying physical U-308 uranium, stockpiling it, and keeping it off the market for the purpose of limiting supply to help push the price up. Seems to me like that is a strategy that could come under intense political pressure if we were to get into a situation where we don't have enough supply to meet demand. There could be really big political pressure to say, hey, you can't do that. You can't corner the market and intentionally take supply off. Is there a risk at some point of Sprott being forced to liquidate for the sake of complying with some kind of governmental demand to not corner the market? And at what point could that happen? And what would it mean in terms of affecting the market if they did have to liquidate and take their supply that's been set aside and sell it into the market? Would that make a huge difference, or would that just be eaten up and consumed very quickly?
It's such a hard question to answer because there's no real great precedent for that. So it's total speculation on whether or not that could even happen. It's a closed-end fund. They have multiple closed-end funds for precious metals. Multiple closed-end funds exist without any historical precedent for any governmental entity forcing them to liquidate what they're holding. In my personal opinion, I think that on the grand scheme of things, looking at the global marketplace and the amount of pounds that are traded and are produced and are bought and sold on an annual basis, what they hold right now, which is about 60 million pounds, it's a lot, but it also is not the savior of this long-term supply scenario that we're looking at here. So it's not really the solution for the utilities. Yes, could it potentially shore up some short-term pain if they were forced to liquidate some of their pounds? That is possible. For them to do it voluntarily, it would have to come to a shareholder vote. I think that they would need a two-thirds shareholder vote, and I doubt that they would ever get that. So as far as the market is concerned, these pounds are being held. They have gone to quote-unquote uranium heaven, and they're unlikely to come back out. Now, they did announce last September at the WNA conference that they were pursuing a redemption feature that would allow the trust to actually redeem to certain unit holders for physical uranium at NAV. And this, I think, was a brilliant idea, honestly, because it essentially would have pegged the vehicle to NAV very, very close. Small discounts on NAV would be bought up by fuel buyers and traders that they can redeem in the future. Of course, that would have been limited to certain players. It would be limited in quantities and timeframes. But I thought it was a great idea. Just recently, they announced they're not going to be electing to go after that physical redemption feature. So as many closed-end funds do, as time goes on, they tend to trade almost exclusively at a discount to their net asset value. That's been the case for SPUT for the past year and a half, with a couple of very, very short-term exceptions. In my personal opinion, Eric, this is a great liquid vehicle to hold to track the price of uranium. Generally, even if it trades at a discount, it's still going to move up with the price of uranium at a discount. But I think they've done the heavy lifting already. They did a big clearing out of the final uranium above ground mobile inventory that existed after the absolute glut of the previous decade, and that was slowly consumed with the shuttering or the care and maintenance of McArthur River and some various other elements that affected the market over those years. I don't have to get into it at this point, but there was a little bit of above ground mobile inventory left, and SPUT cleared it out. And they did it in two big pushes. This was September, October, November of 2021, March and April of 2022. And that's it. Now we're seeing a couple hundred thousand pounds bought and sold in the spot market, and it's moving the price up $1, $2, $3 at a time. So we don't need the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust to trade at a premium and to continue to buy uranium hand over fist. I think that time has passed. Could it happen again? Absolutely. If it does, it's absolutely lights out. I think we'll see a huge price spike if capital floods into this vehicle, but it probably is going to trade pretty persistently at a discount, and that's totally fine with me. We don't need them to buy any more uranium. Honestly, at this point, I don't even think we need any more quote-unquote catalysts. It's all set up. It's an extremely thin market. The demand is easy to project. The price is going to keep going higher.
Justin, final question. On the day that we're speaking, Tuesday after the close, this was a big up day. Everything's up about 5%, both the uranium and uranium miners. What's the news behind that, and where is this headed?
There was a confluence of pieces of news that came out today. One of them being that the Department of Energy announced that they were going to be issuing an RFP for $500 million of LEU and HALEU from domestic producers. We also had very bullish articles written in the Wall Street Journal and Reuters. There was a Seeking Alpha article. And a couple of nights ago, I guess to add fuel to the fire, B of A released another bullish report on uranium, basically putting out much higher price projections for spot uranium for this year and next year. So I think it was just sort of a confluence of factors met with market malaise over the past 6 weeks while the uranium price kept grinding higher. We had big dividends from both ETFs. There was some selling in the market in expectation of URNM selling, which they didn't do. They actually paid for their dividend with block trades, which was hilarious and brilliant. But URA did some selling in the market to fund that dividend. So there was kind of some investor malaise with the equities sort of chopping sideways and the price keep grinding higher for uranium. And I think that everybody was waiting for something to kind of light the match. And it looks like today that match was lit. We'll have to see if this is a sustaining rally here or not. But pretty good breakout volume, some big moves across the sector, and multiple positive stories in multiple different outlets today on nuclear and uranium.
Well, Justin, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. We let it run a little bit long. I'm sure nobody's going to complain about that because it was all excellent content. Before I let you go, though, please tell us a little bit more about Uranium Insider. You're not only a really good newsletter for investors that are interested in uranium, you're pretty much the only show in town. So congratulations on that and also on your outstanding performance. Where can people find out more about it and tell us a little bit about what the product entails?
Yeah, thanks for the kind words, Eric. We can be found at uraniuminsider.com. We publish a monthly newsletter that's 40 plus pages. We have a pretty heavy focus on the nuclear fuel cycle and the nuclear fuel physical market. I think that's the most important thing overall to track, to understand exactly what's happening in that physical market. It can be complicated. We have a very deep network of contacts within the industry that we maintain communications with, and we do our best to distill that information down to our members who are investors in this sector, to basically what it means for an investor in the sector. I would try to take some complicated information and make it simple. I think we've done a pretty good job of that over the years, keeping people hanging on in this investment during very volatile times that can test people's patience and test their gut strength. It's not an easy sector to invest in because of that extreme volatility. Like you mentioned, the sector is up 5% today, just today. It can have very, very wild swings. But we produce a very in-depth newsletter once a month. We do monthly members-only webinars where we bring industry executives on to discuss the macro. We also talk with managers from some of the companies that we recommend. We have a focus list of recommended positions in the sector. That focus list is up about 425% since inception in 2019 compared to URA, which is up about 230% if you include the dividends. So we have a pretty good alpha to the sector with our positioning. And we also do just about daily updates where I'll record a video and send that out to our membership on almost a daily basis, discussing what happened that day in the sector, any pertinent news items pertaining to the sector or the individual companies that we recommend. We just live, eat, and breathe uranium, and we've built up quite a good community here of members, and I think we've got multiple years ahead of us, Eric, based on all the reasons we've discussed today. So I'm very pleased to be doing this. I'm very blessed and very much looking forward to the coming years.
And again, that's at uraniuminsider.com. Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, great interview with Justin. Now, joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Justin's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Now, Eric, let's get to crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory.
EIA printed a surprise build in crude oil inventory this week, building 1.3 million barrels nationally, with Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 506,000 barrels. The really big builds, though, were on the finished products, with gasoline building 8 million barrels and distillates building another 6.5 million barrels. U.S. production held unchanged at 13.2 million barrels. The data have changed, and so has my outlook. My new base case for 2024 is for oil prices to stay about where they are, plus or minus $10 up or down from where they are right now, through most of the year. Demand is clearly weakening, and supply tightness that so many analysts expected has not materialized. I think a lot of the reason for that is that there's more black market supply in the system than official data reflect. Because the Biden administration is so strongly motivated to keep gasoline prices low through the election, I now see the risk of a major Middle East war escalation as an outlier rather than a base case scenario. But that said, I still think the outlier risk is much greater than most market participants perceive. America's enemies understand full well that election year politics create an incentive for Biden to avoid any military escalation that threatens energy prices. And it's already clear that they're going to exploit that weakness as an invitation to test the limits of Biden's restraint. The Houthi attacks on Red Sea shipping are evidence of this. As I see it, Biden faces something of an all-or-nothing conundrum. He can't afford to allow energy prices to just gradually creep higher in a way that the American people might blame him or his policies for. But if the American people perceive President Biden to be responding to a serious threat to the country, and particularly if the situation is presented to them so that they believe that foreign terrorists are to blame for escalating energy prices, and they perceive President Biden to be taking a tough stance to defeat the terrorists responsible for those higher energy prices, then those higher energy prices won't be nearly as damaging to Biden's reelection prospects. So I perceive this as a situation where Biden is likely to continue to mostly stand down and avoid escalation unless and until he sees a clear opportunity to shift the perception of blame for higher energy prices to foreign bad guys. In that scenario, I could easily imagine a very rapid and dramatic escalation of the conflict in a way that does threaten oil supply. Again, that's an outlier risk, not the base case. But my point is, I don't see any reason to expect any slow and gradual buildup to an escalation. The Biden administration will continue to avoid escalation until they decide to go all in. And if they do, which is not certain, it could happen very quickly. But absent such an escalation, I think oil prices are likely to hold present levels and possibly drift lower if economic demand weakens into 2024, which seems entirely possible.
Well, Eric, for me, technically, what we are seeing here is that we, after a 3-month bearish decline in oil, we're finally seeing the environment where, you know, oil gets slammed $3 on a down day and the next day recovers. The type of price action that means that, if at least for now, the selling has subsided. That doesn't in itself make it a new bull trend, but that is a characteristic that is often found near bottoming formations. And if you go back and look on the chart in that May-June period where for 2 months oil stopped making lower lows and consolidated sideways, the question now is, are we seeing a similar style bottoming formation developing? What's really easy about this is that with that 50-day moving average just hovering above, just like the breakout that happened in July above there, that's a really easy arbiter of trend that you could just look for the breakout to see whether oil is starting a new trend. But it wouldn't surprise me if we still spent a week or two just consolidating in here before something more meaningful happens. But let's see whether or not a bottom develops here. Now, moving on to equities, I want to get Nick involved in the conversation. Now, Nick, let's start with that S&P 500. Obviously, we have OPEX coming up next week. What levels are you watching?
Yeah, Patrick. So spot price right now on SPX is approximately 47.90. We have a call wall just above at 4,800 and a put wall below at 4,700, also acting as support. The implied move for next Friday's January 19th OPEX is plus minus 60 points, giving us an implied upside of 4,850 and an implied downside of 4,730. Now, I'm inclined to think that we see a touch of the all-time high at 4,818 approximately, possibly a touch as high as 4,850, but no further than that. Following the January OPEX, I see a window of weakness to the downside, in which case we potentially touch as low as 4,650 area on SPX. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's interesting. Okay, on page 4, I have that chart of the S&P 500 futures. We're testing that previous high. Obviously, CPI was not the big market mover. What was going to be really interesting to me is we have a big earnings coming out. A pig in the python moment for earnings is in the coming week. And then we end with the FOMC rates meeting at the end of the month. And so right now, the prevailing trend is higher. Higher highs, higher lows. Everything is being well accumulated. The breath hasn't started to massively deteriorate in any way. And so you have to respect the prevailing trends and expect that at least on the interim, we may actually make a little bit of a higher high push on this. But what will be interesting is once we get to all these major news events coming up towards the end of the month, will we see February be a trend shift? And will we see the pattern emerge that way? To me, I think we can make it probably into next week's OPEX with the current trend staying in place, and then we'll certainly see how things shape up going into the end of the month. Now, Nick, when we're looking on page 5 on the Qs, what levels are you watching on that NASDAQ?
Right now, spot price on the Qs is approximately 410. We have a call wall right at this level at 410. We have a put wall below at 400, and the implied move for next Friday's January 19th OPEX is plus minus 6 points. Therefore, the implied upside is 416, and the implied downside is 404. Right now, key resistance is currently at 410, where we are right now, all-time highs, and key support is at 400. As I said, weeks past, I'm more bearish on tech than I am on the broad market. I still do favor small caps. Right now, we've seen NVIDIA take off by about 7% in the past week. Meta is almost at all-time highs, and Google is pushing higher as well. Apple has shown weakness, as is Tesla. I'm most bullish right now on Google, actually, for the prime reason that they're actually forcing ads now on YouTube, and you're seeing a lot of ads there. So that's one thing. And then additionally, I think that they've laid off a lot of workers as well, so they should see their margins expand a little bit in the coming quarters. So Google probably bullish there. Meta probably bullish as well, as we're approaching all-time highs at 384 area, only about $13 off there. Nvidia, I think, has ran too far too fast, but again, that's Momo stock at this point, so I won't touch that one at all. But I'm still favoring the small caps if we do get that push to all-time highs on SPX. I think that, you know, the Russell can push up to around 210 on IWM, and that's where I'm placing my bets right now.
Those are interesting observations about the NASDAQ. But for me, the fact that the Mag 7 continue to show leadership is what actually is keeping the prevailing trends going. Obviously, that we can speculate as to when there is going to be a big turn point. And obviously, if we were to have a much bigger market correction at some point, the Mag 7s would certainly have to have topped out and be participating on the downside just simply because of the huge market cap weighting of them. At this moment, what's interesting is that generally the S&P is a bit stronger than the NASDAQ, but the NASDAQ Mag 7s continue to be leadership. And I'm looking for when will we see a divergence in that? And that just hasn't materialized for me. Anyway, let's jump to the volatility index. And what I'm continue to be surprised at is how low volatility is going into what I think is some pretty big news at the end of the month. What's your take on the VIX here?
So right now the VIX is at approximately 13 or so, which denotes that we should see about 0.8% moves top to bottom intraday on SPX. After next Friday's OPEX, I expect the volatility to pick up because the pinning effect of next week's OPEX is very, very great given that it's one of the largest OPEXs based on open interest over the last couple of years. So I expect an expansion of volatility post next Friday, which is why I think that we'll see a decline in markets into the February OPEX perhaps. Now, moving on to page 7, we have the US dollar index. What are your thoughts here, guys?
Well, we've broken through channel resistance now, but it was a horizontal breakthrough as opposed to an upside breakout. The market has been waiting for CPI data as a signal on where Fed policy might go next, so it's not clear yet where the trend is headed. And of course, CPI came in this morning pretty much as expected. So let's see how the market digests today's as expected CPI print and whether or not a new trend is established by next week.
Well, my view on the dollar index is that the prevailing downtrend is intact. Lower highs, lower lows, that resistance at the 102.5 to 103 initially stalling the dollar price action. If the dollar remained weak and went for a double bottom retest of either the July low or just the December low here, would continue to be a tailwind for risk assets. And that therefore may be the short term path of least resistance. With that said, I don't think that there's a big downside risk to the dollar here. While the dollar is certainly in a downtrend, this is probably very close to where we're going to start seeing bottoming formations. And inevitably, when the dollar reacts in some bullish way on the upside, I think it will be on an inner market basis, a big signal. I don't think it's imminent. I don't put a high weighting that it's going to happen this week, between this week and next week. But at some point, it will give a big signal. On the short term, if it was back down to 101, creating a double bottom is certainly something that would not shock me.
Eric, you wanted to take a deeper dive into gold this week. What's on your mind?
Let's take this on in two parts. First, the short to intermediate term outlook, but then since this is our first show of the new year, I'd also like to comment on the longer term big picture of where I see this headed toward the end of the year. In the near term, the pattern of higher highs and higher lows may be starting to falter in the sense that the swing high that we put in on December 27th was equal to the prior swing high from December 1st. So we didn't get a lower high, but we didn't get a higher high either. A lower low, meaning a daily close below 1990, would be cause for real concern, at least in the short to intermediate term. But after CPI came in pretty much as expected, I think the market is already trying to put in a swing low here. The slow stochastics have already started to flatten out, and we've already tested channel support with this week's intraday plunge down to 1222. So long as we can stay above 1200, the pattern of higher lows will remain intact. Patrick, I'd be curious to get your take on the pattern of higher swing highs giving way to an equal high on December 27th, just above the key resistance level of 2085, which we've been watching for months now.
Eric, on page 8, I have that gold chart and put that 50-day moving average on there. And you can see that generally this entire pullback on gold has simply a mean reverted back to a moving average that has found support in the past. If we see generally the risk-on impulse working, the dollar, let's say, and it deviates back down to its lows, there's nothing stopping gold from going back and retesting highs again and generally trade ranging up along these highs. But generally, I still think on the very short term, there's volatility risk. Ultimately, if we at some point see the stock market to have a hiccup and start to pull back and risk assets are sold, then obviously gold heading back to 1900 would not be a huge shocker on the short term. But in the bigger picture, I think that there's lots of opportunity.
Moving on to the bigger picture now, I'm convinced that 2024 will be the year that we'll break out to new all-time highs, and probably a lot higher than that. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see the market above 2,500 a year from now. The reason is that while we don't yet know the timing, it's nearly a certain bet that by the end of the year, the Fed will begin cutting interest rates. Even if we see a modest return of inflation, pressure to reduce the federal government's borrowing costs is mounting as deficits run out of control and the national debt continues to grow to mind-boggling levels. And for those of us who've been convinced that the Fed is a lot more political than it likes to admit, the very notion of abandoning an already announced plan to cut interest rates in an election year seems completely implausible. Now, the market loves to embarrass as many people as it possibly can, and long gold has already become a very crowded trade in anticipation of this upside breakout to new all-time highs. So I don't rule out the possibility of a sharp correction, perhaps as low as 1900 or slightly below that level, especially if the Fed is slower to begin cutting than many people have predicted. But before this year is out, I expect higher prices and probably much higher prices. Patrick, I know a lot of our listeners are thinking, as I am, about how to leverage the upside potential with options, especially if we get a buy on dip opportunity below the current market. Patrick, you're Mr. Webinar, and I, for one, would love to hear your thoughts on how to play the breakout to new all-time highs that I'm expecting to see sometime this year, and in much more detail than we have time for here on the podcast. Now, I'm guessing that you've probably already got something along those lines planned for your big picture trading subscribers. So I'm going to do my job here to advocate for our listeners. And Patrick, can I persuade you to throw in a freebie webinar as a holiday gift for our Macro Voices listeners?
Eric, my position is completely aligned with your view. While the next few months have plenty of room for volatility in both directions, we are in a perfect macro backdrop for an extraordinary new bull breakout in gold later this year. The key for most listeners that agree with this view is how to position yourself to maximize your returns. I'm going to be doing a special webinar on Monday, January 15th at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, going into depth on the macro thesis and strategies on how you can magnify your gains in the coming new gold bull market. You can find the link in the Research Roundup email or visit bigpicturetrading.com to register for the free webinar.
Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup. And while you're at it, please tell our listeners again where they can sign up for your free webinar on how to play the coming gold bull market using options.
In this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the link to Justin's slide deck and the chart book we just discussed here in the post game, including a link to a number of articles that we found really interesting, as well as the link to the special free gold webinar that I'm doing on Monday, January 15th at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can also register for the webinar at bigpicturetrading.com. You're going to find that link and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you've not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That is Eric spelled with a K. And follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.